The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
This morning I'm going to talk about a koan in the Gateless Gate collection, case number 12. And first, I want to read it as it's usually translated, or at least a version that we're familiar with if we work with it in our Boundless Way Zen koans. Every day, Ruyan Shiyan would call to himself, "Master." "Yes," he would answer himself. "Be wide awake," he would say. "Yes." Whatever the time, whatever the day, never be misled by others. "Yes, yes." That's the whole koan. And we've been enjoying the translations by David Hinton, which are translated directly from the kanji, the Chinese characters that form this collection. And so he calls people by the names that their names mean. I was thinking the other day, if we did that for me, my name in David Hinton's book would be Honeybee, Wondrous Accomplishment, Firefly Hall, Tinsmith Roshi. So Ruyan's name in David Hinton's translation is Crag Auspicious Mountain. Not Craig Auspicious Mountain, I want to be clear, but Crag Auspicious Mountain. And this was where he lived. He lived on top of Ruyan. An means mountain, and Rui in this case means Crag Auspicious. So this is David Hinton's translation of this koan. "Master Crag Auspicious Mountain, Magisterial Teacher, called out to himself every day, 'Empty One.' And he answered himself, 'Exactly.' Then he said, 'Awake, always awake.' 'Exactly.' Through all the marvelous days of times to come, refuse the delusions of people. Through all the marvelous days of times to come, refuse the delusions of people." Exactly, exactly. And here's Wu Min, or as David Hinton calls him, No Gate. Here's No Gate's comment. "Old Master Crag Auspicious. He's buying himself and selling himself at once here. He's playing this game with phantom faces and ghost masks, flocks of them. And why has he turned himself into spirits who've already died and died again? One calling out and one answering, one awake, always awake, and one refusing the delusions of people. Devote yourself to anything as the one and only, and you're lost. Trust yourself to any other, and you're a wild fox full of sly schemes." And his poem, Wu Min's poem, or Gatha. "Study Wei and you never know what's absolute. Instead, you cling to those phantoms people have treasured from the outset. The origin of birth and death, immeasurable, outlasting kalpas. Live simple-minded enough, and you see in it your original self." So this koan in all its forms is one I have a particular love for. I think because before I started playing with koans myself, with my teachers, I listened to Dharma talks like this, to Taisho like this, and my teachers, Richard Clark and James Ford and now John Tarrant, all tend to gravitate towards koans that they happen to really love. And so I heard the same koans again and again from all three of these teachers. And of course, at every sesshin, most sesshins, I should say, not everyone, but we usually pick a koan and we give many, many teisho on it, the same koan again and again and again, learning about it, going deep into it. At our koan salons now, we take a koan and we play with it in a group setting. And so one of the koans that I used to hear a lot from my first teacher, and which, of course, made a deep impression on me, was this one. And that teacher, gave so many different teisho on it. It was like an ongoing theme, in a way. This parts of the self talking to each other, and also a way of looking at what it means to be awake in this world. And it never means what we think it means. And Wu Men throws a whole bunch of hints at us to help us to understand and not get caught and not get fooled, which is the translation I first heard. I first heard Ruyan say, don't be fooled by others. And then the last line of the poem is here it's live simple-minded enough, but in almost all the translations I've discovered, it says, fools live in such a way. So this being foolish and not being foolish, being simple-minded and being clear, being awake and being deluded, this koan, if you really look into it deeply, which we're going to do this morning, I hope, is full of these contradictions, these voices calling out to each other. And aren't we like that? Inside these brains and hearts and bodies, inside this skin bag that contains all the blood and flesh and muscle of a human being, the pulsating energy of a person, aren't we always separating ourselves into this and that, into different voices talking to each other? I don't know about you, but I talk to myself, sometimes out loud. If I stub my toe or drop something, suddenly I become Christian. Jesus, Jesus. And I talk to myself in other ways. Sometimes when nobody's around, somebody said to me the other day, oh, you really love people, don't you? People say stuff to me all the time about who I am. I guess it's part of the role. Luckily, just like with this guy, Ruyan, they all contradict each other. But anyway, somebody was saying, oh, you really love people. And I said, well, you know, actually, I love to be alone. And the person who said this to me, really? No. But the fact is, I do love to be alone. And when I'm alone, sometimes I look around, nobody's around, wherever I happen to be, whether it's here or in our cottage or in a hotel room somewhere or a retreat center bedroom. And I just do a little dance. And I go, yay! Talking to myself, just like this guy, Ruyan. This is a normal thing, I hope. I don't think it's diagnosable. I may not be the only one who does it, as I've mentioned. But I think I had an idea before I heard this koan that someday I would eliminate all the different parts of myself and just be whole and complete. And the whole and complete looked a lot like my Zen teachers. It didn't really look like me, which is really interesting because all of my Zen teachers have been men. How do we become the person we actually are? Well, the clues in this koan point the way to us to embrace everything about ourselves. It's easy to embrace our compassion and our wisdom. Well, actually, I take that back. Some of us even struggle with that. Who, me? No. Are you kidding? No. I'm not wise. I'm not compassionate. No, 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 no. Kind of a constant no to anything that might contradict our holding tight to some idea of ourself which is limited and small and awful. If somebody does come to us and say, you are limited and small and awful, it, for some of us, it matches so closely to what we think about ourselves that we go, yes, yes, I am. I'm so sorry. I just need to do more zazen, I think. maybe someday I'll be good. People toss around all kinds of things at us. This is the not being fooled. This is the not being caught by the delusions of others. And those others include ourselves. Not being caught by our own delusions. And just turning this around a little bit, or maybe a lot, turning it completely upside down, which is a thing that happens often in Zen practice and in teaching. All of the things that we don't like about ourselves are important parts of ourselves. They do not need to be thrown out, carved away. They don't need to be fixed. Robert Bly, the wonderful poet who is a Sufi practitioner, actually, is a person of the way, we might say, just in another style. He talks a lot about everyone being born with a little black bag. We're given the bag as soon as we really attain self-aware consciousness, and actually we've had it all along, and every time something happens that we say, oh, I don't like this about myself, that's not really me, that's not what I want to be, we stuff it in the black bag, and the black bag is infinitely expandable. And so by the time we get to be middle-aged, usually these black bags, which we drag around with us, are bigger than we are. All the parts of the self that we don't like, throwing them away, pretending that, no, I never have an angry thought. I'm never sad. I'm never upset. I'm never afraid. I'm a brave, courageous bodhisattva. Leave me alone. It's not like that. All of these activities are what makes us human. We may idealize some idea. Well, I guess that's what idealizing is, isn't it? It's solidifying an idea about how we should be. But the teaching of Zen is very clear on this. Who we should be is who we have been already and will continue to be. This is not a self-improvement program. There are self-improvement programs, and everyone is welcome to go to them. There are wonderful methodologies around psychological growth and healing and all the wounds that assail us, and we can refine ourself, our little self, so that it behaves a little bit better. But ultimately, in Zen practice anyway, we have to open to the whole deal. The things we love about ourselves, which is hard for some of us, and also the things we hate about ourselves, which is where we get to learn and grow. Whatever your thing is, and really things, because all of us carry all of these histories and tenderizing experiences, whatever it is, the idea is not to fix it, to repair it, to smooth it over and then throw it in the black bag, which just becomes a heavier burden. The unintegrated parts of the self are not gone. It's not to fight it, although sometimes we fight really hard. We fight reality. As one of my other teachers, a non-Zen teacher, used to say to me, we fight reality, and that's a useless prospect because in that fight, reality always wins. The way things are the way things are. And it's hard to remember this. I had a stomach ache this morning, and in the middle of having the stomach ache, I was thinking, oh, why are you having a stomach ache? You're such a failure as a human being. Your body is so unreliable. And then I remembered this teaching And I stopped myself and I said, what is going on? Look at you fighting with reality. And in that moment, my stomach ache didn't go away. But the light from the window in the bathroom struck my face. It had been doing it all along, but I hadn't noticed because I was so preoccupied with my failure. This is what Ruyan is pointing to us by saying, don't be deluded. So fighting is one thing, and then we talked yesterday about this, it's become so common in our culture and in our world today that it feels like just a way that human beings are, but it's not necessary to be this way, to be addicted to these parts of ourself that are ready to go, but we don't know who we'd be without them. And we're addicted also to being numbed out because it hurts so much. As Ray said yesterday, life sucks, a translation of the first teaching of the Buddha. So we run away. We learn how to run away from early infancy and we get to be masters of it. We turn away from life, from this amazing energy. I think the line in David Hinton's translation that really woke me up when I found it was, through all the marvelous days of times to come. Not just talking about the future, which is how this line is often translated. No matter what happens, it says. But marvelous things are happening. Pain will happen. Loss happens. Awful, awful things are happening everywhere. This marvelous aspect, though, is not about good or bad. It's about having a stomach ache and seeing the sunlight come in the window at the same time. If we are turning away from life, we miss it all. We miss the stomach ache, which is just as important. We miss the light. We miss our life. But the culture really pushes us in that direction. And so at its extreme side, we have people who are drug addicts and alcoholics, sex addicts and other kinds of addicts. But if we're honest, all of us do this. Even if we don't use substances, we use our beautiful creative minds to not be here. And we have lots of different ways of doing that, of avoiding life. So we fight life and we avoid life. And then we also, when we talk about greed, anger, and ignorance, this is really the ignorance portion. We do this funny thing where we pretend that everything's okay. We say, I'm a Zen student and I know that I'm calm and collected in the face of everything. I'm not bothered by these things anymore. It's a kind of, we call it delusive certainty. And in delusive certainty, we also deny our life. We turn away from the energy. So what an amazing thing this guy, who is an awakened master, there's not a lot we know about him. We know that he was a student of Yan To, who was a student of Daishan, and you remember the wonderful stories about Yan To we've already heard here, or you've heard in other talks. The old teacher Daishan has this this guy who's his head monk, his head student, who acts up and creates all these problems, and the intimacy between the two of them is quite beautiful. Yan To then goes off and becomes a teacher himself with the cook of the monastery, Shui Do, and the two of them have all kinds of adventures, and then they go off on their own and still communicate with each other. Yan To was a great, great master, in his own right. It's said that when he died, he was actually killed by robbers. They took over the temple, and they ran him through with a sword. And he shouted so loud at that moment that it carried for miles and miles and miles. And 1,000 years later, Hakuin, a Japanese teacher, had heard that story about Yantō, and he said, wait a minute, this was when he was a student, wait a minute, I thought being a Zen person meant you didn't suffer anymore. I thought everything dropped away. How could this guy yell at the moment of his death? And it propelled him to go deeper into studying the way. I hope it propels you in the same way. I hope Ruyan, Yantō's great student, also inspires you to be awake, to remind yourself we can't remember. We forget all the time. We get sucked back into the black bag of denial, the shadow self. We get sucked into it all the time, which is why we have each other. We have three treasures in our Zen practice, three jewels. The Buddha, the awakened heart that is our birthright, the Dharma, the teachings, stuff like this, the way we teach each other, and the Sangha, the community of practitioners. It is too hard to do this alone. So this is, I like to call it a technology for awakening. If you have one of those elements missing, if you just have the Buddha and the Dharma, but you don't have a community to tell you, cut that shit out, then you can't keep going. If you have the Buddha and the Sangha, but no Dharma, no teacher to tell you, cut that shit out, then also that's a problem. And if you have the Dharma and the Sangha, people telling you all the time to cut that shit out, but you don't remember that that shit is the Buddha nature, and then you're lost also. So they all balance each other. The teachings beautifully balance each other. And even a greatly awakened master, what Hinton calls the magisterial teacher, calls out to himself every day. In the usual translation, it's master, but here it's empty one. Hey, you, remember? You're a Zen master, for goodness sake. Hey, you, empty one. And he says, in this translation, exactly. Like, all right, thank you, thank you, thank you. I forgot. I needed myself to remind myself. And then he says, awake, always awake. Rumi has a poem where he says over and over again, don't go back to sleep. But you know we do. We have little moments of awakening or big ones. And then everything is great, and then we solidify that, and we think, oh yeah, great, I had this experience, let me tell you about it. Don't go back to sleep. Stay awake. Be awake. Exactly. Exactly, Ruyan says. And then this line. Through all the marvelous days of times to come. Do you ever think about your life like that? Most of us live with dread and fear and anxiety about the future. But what if we could look forward to not knowing what comes next? We know that ultimately, again, our friend Rumi says, we're all going through the same door, the door of death. Everything ends for us personally, even though things go on, the energy keeps going. But Rumi says, what's your hurry? How about now? How about this moment? The marvelous moment of this moment, right here, right now. Don't miss it. We're alive now. Sesshin like this, which are so long, but even short ones, we do the same thing. We think, and Esther's mentioned it a few times, we're over the halfway point. And I think that, too. I think, oh, we're over the halfway point. And then I stop myself, just like Rhea, and say, what? What does that mean? Really, time is so weird. This will be over before we know it. We'll be in cars and planes and buses off home, or we'll be walking down the street or going up the stairs, in the case of a couple of us. And what's marvelous next? To anticipate in this way is to recognize that everything we need is right here. And the delusion of time is hurting us. We can't stop doing it. If we did, it would just be another item to go in the black bag. So we appreciate it. We say, oh, look at me being so worried. Look at me being so fearful of what comes next. And of course, Ruyan says then, refuse the delusions of people. In the marvelous days to come, don't be fooled. Refuse the delusions of people. Don't let anything tell you different than what you've discovered inside the breath, inside this body, in this building, in the experiences of walking and sitting and eating and sleeping. Every moment, completely precious. And Ruyan says to himself, exactly, exactly. Yes, yes. Remember that koan from last week, some of you were here, where someone asks the teacher, what is Buddha? And the teacher says, yes. Exactly. Your question is exactly to the point. Master Craig, auspicious mountain magisterial teacher, called out to himself every day, empty one. And he answered himself, exactly. Then he said, awake. Always awake. Exactly. Through all the marvelous days of time to come, refuse the delusions of people. Exactly. Exactly. Thank you. So please stretch out, make yourselves comfortable. We'll have our Dharma dialogue. And remember, this is being recorded, so if you want something off the record, just let us know.
I have a question that part of me knows the answer to, but I'm asking on behalf of the self that doesn't. And that is, maybe I should just use a very concrete example. There are things in my life, at least, that I find myself doing over and over and over, that are self-destructive, or, you know, aren't self, I mean, they put me at a disadvantage. I block myself from accomplishing things because of it. But let me use a better example. I'm chronically late, which is not very zen of me. In those moments, I don't actually understand it. I mean, most of the time. So obviously, one thing to do about it is to sit a lot of zen and sit zazen and get to know myself and pay attention. But that sort of thing, where I am late yet again and I'm inconveniencing someone else, or, you know, it's very hard to greet that with a, oh, this is Buddha nature, wonderful. And I wonder if there are any, you know, if there's anything to say about that other than keep looking at it, you know? Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. Maybe other people have similar examples, but in the moment where it's happening yet again, I have the feeling the black bag is black because it's not black. It's you don't see it, right?
It's the shadow.
It's affecting your posture. Mm-hmm. But you don't really know it's even there, right? Mm-hmm. So clearly, if I'm chronically late, I am doing something, expressing something, and I've been aware of it as a challenge for a long time, but it doesn't mean I stopped doing it. It's very strange.
It reminds me of a book called The Game of Inner Tennis, actually quite a lovely book, and he talks about how in tennis, mostly if you hit a bad shot, mostly you think, I'm such a poor player. And he encourages when you hit a bad shot to really hit the bad shot, right? To really stay with it. And I think this is what you're talking about. You're noticing the cringe, like late again.
Yes.
And that is quite, the ego really likes that because it's very solid. So every time you're late, at least you're right about yourself.
Yeah.
I may be late, but I know who I am, goddammit.
Yeah.
I'm the one who's always late. And so it gets used that way. And there's a certain satisfaction we take in our perpetual failure. And it's so important to see the attachment to this idea that I am always late. Is it true you're always late? You know, I'm sure there's some times when, and late. But anyway, want to agree with the side of you that says, pay attention. So this is a koan. There are, of course, these things that we do, and we don't even know we're doing them.
Right.
Then there is some kind of awareness. And that's the hard part because it's hard to bear. Seeing that, like I, you know, and all the stories that come up, but through our practice, can you take this on as koan? Like, wow, what is this here? How does this operate? What's here now? So some treasure here for you. And maybe inexhaustible treasure.
Oh dear.
So, thank you.
Yes, yes.
So arising for that, I'm in. So does change matter?
What
does change matter?
It doesn't matter if it matters. It happens all the time, right?
Oh, maybe there's something else.
Maybe there's something else.
I can relate in my own way to habits.
Yes.
I see it, I do it, I see it, I keep doing it. And something in me wants it to be different or to stop doing it or to change. And if I can practice being with as a manifestation of the Buddha, or at least I'm the best way I can express that, then that's where my question comes from. So, should I stop trying to change my bad habits?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. I would say start... No. There's a part two.
Woo-hoo! Watch out!
All right.
Sorry.
So listen carefully. Listen carefully to this, James.
But she said I don't
need to hear it.
So, yes, in the sense that if your work is to change the habit, you will be constantly fighting the habit. You will not be present in your own life. You will be saying, someday I'll be free of this. I'm going to be on time now because, you know, then, I don't know, people will stop being upset with me, people will like me, whatever the habit is. And the idea, and this is what Will was pointing to and David affirmed, is to actually not invest all your energy in changing, but invest all your energy in befriending, getting to know, meeting, thoroughly investigating this habit. Because habits are replacements for being awake. If we know we have a habit that's causing harm in the world, we're shut down in that place. It's a place we go to where we don't have to think about stuff.
So you want to wake up. This is what Ruyan was telling us. Wake up. You know, come on. Stop it. You're always late? Okay, so now you have a sense of yourself as a person who's always late. I'm not going to be late anymore. I'm going to do something. And there's, you know, well, we used to say there are bookstores full of books about this. But I think there are Kindles loaded up with self-help books about, you know, how to not be late, how to not be blah, 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 blah. How to not be this, that, or the other thing. No, be it. Get to know it. You know, as we say, be the Buddha of lateness. Be the Buddha of whatever it is that some people know very well what you're talking about, the bad habits. And then they change on their own. But sometimes not in the way you want them to. We have to be open to a new life. And we cling to the habits. I think that we've been saying this. You know, that as our identity. That's dangerous too, because this is about seeing through identity. You know, I am not this kind of person. I am a person who thinks, feels, does these things, or has in the past and will do other things in the future. Right? Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So it's not really a question, it's a pointer. Investigate. Yeah.
I would also add that Seamus, when you say I want to change, you're starting with a fixed idea of what a changed Seamus would look like, right? And that's
all.
So to let that go, just let that go, and the possibilities of a changed Seamus can arise, you know.
And just to add to that, thank you. That's so great. There will be a changed Seamus, no matter what. You know, we cannot avoid sickness, aging, and death. That's just going to happen to you. So, I mean, I hope the aging happens. You know, that's the good thing. But sickness and death, yeah, that's pretty certain. So we can trust change. But yeah. Thank you for that question. So I think. Dave, did you have your hand?
So the Zen master, being a Zen master, has kind of a habit at this point of waking himself up because he knows he's probably not.
Yes.
He is, in a sense, his own goddamn sangha. But he's in this container. Change inner habituations markedly, surrounded by literal, I guess, Zen miners, masters, and people earnestly modeling the way and choosing a wakeful culture. And then you step out and you've got the internet, you've got the radio in your car, you've got your email inbox, you know? And then, yes, there's sangha, but there's not, I mean, it's not like living in an intentional community like people did 1,000 years ago. And then everything, in my experience, I was going to say goes to shit, but, well, it does, but it, in a different, maybe slightly softer way that doesn't necessarily induce less suffering.
Thank you for so well put. And one, I think intentional communities are highly overrated. As you say, you know, for eons, human beings have come together in temples and monasteries and intentional communities. And they are always terrible places, wonderful places too. And there does seem something about this time-limited thing that we're doing here. If we were all living together for another year, So there's something about this leaving daily life to go on retreat, to do a kind of work, and then re-entering the sangha of daily life. And of course, we get lots of feedback from daily life too, and different challenges. And in some ways, this group of people, so the Sangha of this morning, we will never gather together again. It will not be these exact people, and yet. Each one of us takes all of us with us. So when we go off, if there is a time when we go back to our daily life, I'm beginning to wonder, then something goes with us, this work we do together. I still have vivid images of the people who sat next to me on retreats 40 years ago. Remember how someone straightened her cushion one night late when I was so discouraged, and she was so careful with her cushion. And to this day, she walks next to me. So this great Sangha of the heart. Yeah. Thank you.
Esther, you put your hand up.
So something about what you brought up, Seamus, with change and... So when some of my black bag stuff comes up, and I have a big one, make no mistake, comes up at home in the family, teenage daughter, brought together family, grown daughters of my husband, the whole complexity. And I enter into my, what do you call it, blind alleys, blind spots. Right, there's something I want to push away. And to have the curiosity, what is it I want to push away? Not just out here, I'm here. And at those times, my husband sometimes says, why don't you do some of that Zen stuff? Bring it up now.
It's fighting words.
It's like, I'm just reminded of a friend that once brought us a book that says something about Buddhists don't attack, and not always so. In those moments where I could easily take that on and think, well, I should change something about myself. This is deep-rooted. I've done this my whole life, now I'm doing it again. And learning something about leaping into the boundless, taking a deep dive, and I don't have to know what's next. So it's kind of what you pointed to, I think, Mike. The change, do we know what change is required? Do we know what change is possible? And I beginning to sense a bit that if I let go and I don't know at all, and I just sort of leave it up to whatever conditions arise, if I keep my mouth shut for a minute or sit down, then something might come up, a possibility of a different way of being right there, and I don't have to do all the work, and that the Dharma or whatever will come out and support a change once I see enough the agent of it all.
Yeah. I think you're pointing to this not knowing, which is, I think, similar to what Ruyan is saying, this marvelous possibility. If we're really awake to change and not being able to predict and not stuck in some idea of the change, then many things can happen. It's actually, you talked about this the other day, Mike, in terms of creativity.
Yeah.
If we know where we're going, we miss everything. But if we come into this wider view, there are many more possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are a few possibilities. In the beginner's mind, there are many, as Shinrikyo Suzuki said. So this is what you're pointing to.
And I would add the what most said is the word awake. I think that's the key. Because you could also do the same thing and just go asleep and say, well, just let the Dharma all over me, things will just happen.
Yeah. And I think that the change you want is part of the problem.
Right.
Right? It comes from that old, it's part of the bottle. It's part of that glass bottle, the goose in the bottle. And I think, well, I know what should happen, and this is the change I want, and I'm going to make it, but that's, I will not be late again. And then the more we fight, the more energy we give that, that the more solid it becomes. And this possibility. A friend of mine told me this story about being in the middle of some family drama, and he just got so exhausted that he just slumped to the floor and sat on the floor. And his partner then came down and sat next to him. What a wonderful new strategy.
And that's completely connected to what we're talking about own the addiction, right? Yeah. So I'm exhausted in this fight. Own it. I'm rushing. I'm always rushing. Own the rushing. Whatever it is. There was a sweet moment. I don't know if everybody saw it when Seamus put his hand up above his head. And I mentioned, yeah, we could be taller as a vertically challenged person myself. That's what it's like, you know. I could be something else. I could be taller. I could be shorter. I could be, you know. And then the most dangerous things are the things that really appear to be achievable. Like, I could stop being late. I could lose weight. I could work out. You know, I could stop being such an asshole. We think those things could happen. But instead, what if we just embraced it all? You know, I'm a short, difficult asshole. You know, I'm just making that up. That's not how I think about myself. Wouldn't that be great? You know, okay, all right. I don't know what's next.
Yeah. And nasty, brutish, and short.
Yes, nasty, brutish, and short. Nasty British, did you say? Oh, I'm thinking about somebody else. Okay, so let's all come to sitting. And we'll go on into the marvelous future.